Heard, House Judiciary Committee is in session. It's 5 minutes past one. In attendance for Representative Grunberg, Representative Herron, who are happy to have back, Representative Gatto, myself, Representative Ramirez, and Representative Dahlstrom is at a leadership meeting. Representative Hawker is with us. We're going to take up that piece of legislation first, which is House Bill 386. Is that right?
386.
Representative Hawker, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure to be with you. For your record, my name is Representative Mike Hawker. I represent District 32 in South Central Alaska.
Welcome, Representative Hawker. Nice to have you here. You want to introduce the bill, or is Julie going to help you?
I would be very pleased to, Mr. Chairman. It's my pleasure to bring before you today House Bill 386. This bill was crafted largely with the inspiration, assistance, and at the request of the Department of Public Safety, who have brought forward what I tend to call this the Ticket Simplification Act. It's needless to say, the public safety world floats on a sea of paper, and that so much of the paperwork over time has sort of, you know, it's grown diverse, cumbersome, inconsistent. What HB 386 provides is it gives the Department of Public Safety the authority to prescribe what really is a uniform citation format and a process for moving citations forward. Particularly, it's over, I think it's been, as the department described it, over 35 years of accumulated judicial fixes and interpretations. Things have gotten somewhat out of alignment that could be brought into alignment with much greater efficiency for the operation of the state's justice system and the paperwork that's necessary to process. Particularly, will facilitate the electronic utilization, or the utilization of electronic records, where, of course, a consistent format is essential to efficient processing of electronic systems as we continue to develop those. That's truly the long and short of the act. If it would serve the committee, Mr. Chairman, the details of this act, is I've got to go gavel in my own meeting here before too long here, but Ms. Lucky on my staff would be happy to provide any detailed support and a detailed explanation of the bill. And then, of course, we have a team of experts in the field here, Department of Law, Department of Public Safety, and the courts to answer any questions folks might have in those arenas.
Thank you, Representative Hawker. We appreciate it. Julie is very capable. We're delighted to sit with her and let you get on to your business. It's nice to see you.
Thank you, sir. You'll have a much better time with her.
Other questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, we thank you very much
for
your time this morning or this afternoon. Hi, Julie.
Good afternoon, Chairman Ramirez and members of the House Judiciary Committee. My name is Julie Lucky. I am staff for Representative Mike Hawker from District 32. And if I might, I would like to deviate from going through a sectional analysis. For those of you that have looked through the 63 sections of the bill, you'll see there's a lot of redundant language. And so I wrote a short summary overview paper. It should be two pages. And it starts with the kind of the meat of the bill, which is in section 21. And is, if it's all right, I think that we can start from there. So what's considered in sections 21 through 31 of the bill, that's the uniform citation process and format. So what it outlines is what needs to be considered, what needs to be in the format of each citation so that we have a consistent format for citations. It clarifies when an officer can issue a citation instead of making an arrest. It sets standard and consistent deadlines for getting citations to the court, for answering citations if you are not required to go to court, and what must be done with the scheduled offenses, which are those offenses that you don't need to go to court for that have a specific fine or bail associated with them. It outlines record-keeping processes, and it makes us a consistent penalty for failure to pay your fine or appear in court. The reason that the bill is so long is that a lot of the different deadlines, it might be 15 days or 30 days to pay certain citations, those are all now in each specific citation statute, whereas what we're doing is kind of consolidating them into these statutes and then referencing all of the individual statutes to those sections, which are sections 1225-175 through sections 1225-230. And so you'll see those citation references throughout the bill. That's pretty much what the bill does, and I think that it might be best to open it up to specific questions, which I can try to answer. We do have some folks that know a little bit more about the technical aspects of why we got here, depending on what the question is.
Julie, it's a pretty straightforward piece of legislation. Representative Holmes has joined us. Representative Holmes and Representative Gatto have questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have a whole lot of questions on it. One that I did have was, I believe in the sponsor statement, one of the goals mentioned being able to pay through the court's online e-payment system. And I looked through, and the bill language throughout the bill refers to mailing or personally delivering to the clerk of the court the amount of bail and copies of the citation. And I just wanted to be clear whether or not that language would allow somebody to pay it online.
And Representative Holmes, through the chair, it is my understanding that since that's language that is currently in statute, that does allow to pay online, but I can have someone from DPS answer that. I'm not quite sure what the process is for the payment
We have Lieutenant Peterson online to answer that question for you. Lieutenant Peterson, are you with us?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I am. This is Lieutenant Kat Peterson with the State Troopers.
Hi, Lieutenant. Did you hear Representative Holmes' question? It went to being able to pay online.
Yes, Representative Holmes, through the chair, the answer to that is they are already allowed to pay online through the court. So the verbiage to bring in person or mail in is what's in the law, but does not in any way stop them from the e-payment. The e-payment portion of this bill allows us to, cleaning up the language of this bill allows us to be able to electronically transfer information quicker from not only our own department, from other law enforcement departments to the court quicker, which allows people to be able to get online and pay easier. Right now there's a lot of delay in being able to pay online, even if the court is set up to do that in certain areas of the state, because the court hasn't received the citation yet and hasn't put it in their system, so you can't pay it until it gets there. Those are some of the things, efficiencies we're trying to smooth out with this bill.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I may rephrase just to be sure, what I'm hearing is that the sections that allow e-payment are in other parts of the statutes and should be fine to continue doing e-payment without amending any of the language in front of us.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Julie, page 7, there's a lot of deleted language, but there is some that remains, especially on line 5. And same thing on line 21, the word shall accept. We have seen instances on television of not taking it. So how do we enforce shall accept?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, yeah, that is a good question. I think DPS might be the right people, since they are the people with the boots on the street, to answer that question.
I'm reading. Sorry, it's interesting. It's an interesting question.
Mr. Chairman, I appear to have a lifeline from the audience.
Sorry, I'm really just trying to reach my own conclusion, actually. Thank you very much for the help. Representative Lynn has joined us. Representative Gatto, you're referring to page 7, line 21. Is that right?
You're not going to have the audience vote. You're going to
5 and 21 both.
Yeah, I'm Simon Cowell. I'm going to decide myself.
I'm Dave Brower, Assistant Attorney General, who helped draft the bill, and I deleted a lot of that language. On line 5 and line 21, I looked at the language that's currently in there. It says the person cited shall give a written promise to appear in court by signing at least one copy. I didn't think it would change the through the chair, Representative Gatto's concern that people who won't accept it, the same people won't sign. And you can't force somebody to sign or accept. So I thought it would kind of streamline this. And by deleting a lot, there's a lot of language in here that includes certain citations that you did have to sign for that, or that you didn't have to sign for. And since the import of the bill is to make things quicker without having to sign for it, and the officer would give them to him, the officer would certify under penalty of perjury that he did provide a copy. So that would eliminate the necessity of having certain offenses you have to sign for and certain offenses that you don't have to sign for. And I had the same concern that you did, but I thought the people that would not give a written promise or wouldn't accept it would be the same issues. And in another section, it may allow the person to arrest that person.
And thanks, Mr. Chair. That's exactly what I was wondering. The final authority is with the arresting officer, who says, "I'm going to give you a citation," and you back up. He touches your hand; it falls to the ground. And I just don't know if the law is going to cover that. If the peace officer says that either you accept it or I'm forced to arrest you, is in the bill.
I think that's already in the statutes in Title 12. There are certain offenses where an officer doesn't have authority to arrest unless the person refuses to identify themselves or issues like that. So I think through the chair, Representative Gatto, those concerns are already addressed in the law. The officer would have the authority to arrest.
And if I may, so I would guess that is under similar consideration as if you're accused of DUI and you won't take a test, then you're arrested.
Well, not quite. Through the chair, I think the concerns are the same. If an officer is going to issue a citation, he has to have probable cause to believe the offense occurred, as with the DUI. And I'm not sure what test you're talking about, but if it's a field sobriety test, the officer would have to have enough articulable reasons and probable cause to arrest without the field sobriety test.
Thank you.
Other questions?
I have a number of questions. Please don't go. But I thought I'd wait until everybody else had asked theirs, because I want to be sure I have mine all together.
Are there any other questions from the committee, Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 6, line 10, just wondering if you could give us a little bit of background on the change, or deleting "has reasonable and probable cause to believe" and change it to the words "reasonably believes." What, if any, difference that makes?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, that doesn't have any practical difference. I just looked at the wording "has reasonable and probable cause to believe" as being at least redundant. Probable cause is a term that is used in when an officer makes a determination to arrest somebody for a particular crime. The elements of that crime have to be met. And in this case, it's whether a person is dangerous or has committed a particular crime. He already has probable cause for that crime. So this is a danger to self or others is primarily the concern that the officer has at that point. So it doesn't have any practical effect.
Thank you.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Browder, through the chair. I had a number of questions. I apologize. I haven't had a chance to go through this as much as I want. And I'm just going through a second time now with my questions. I'd like you to look at Section 7 and 8. And the language you're adding in Section 8, the first couple of things there on lines 13 and 14 is similar to the language in lines basically 6 and 7. And my question is, if a peace officer who has probable cause boards the watercraft or boards the boat, does that give them a right to search for stuff in plain view without a warrant?
Well, I think if it's in plain view, they wouldn't be searching. The...
To seize without a warrant.
Well, if it's contraband, I believe they already have that right. Even though this, through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, even though this section has been repealed and reenacted, the language, the peace officer still has to have probable cause to believe the violation has occurred to board the boat, so that's not new. And I should have made a copy of what the current law says, but I just thought it would be easy to repeal it and reenact it. But certainly if the officer is aboard the boat and sees contraband in plain sight, they would be able to seize it.
Let me make sure you understand what I'm getting at. Under Section 8, they'll now be able to board the craft simply because they have probable cause to believe the violation has occurred. I haven't studied that chapter, but I assume that some of those violations would not necessarily otherwise have given them probable cause to board the watercraft. And the thing I'm concerned about is now she'll be able to board the craft, and then things that would not otherwise or previously have been in plain view would be in plain view, and they could seize those items without getting a search warrant. In other words, you could have a watercraft that has a cabin in it, and that would allow them presumably, or even if it had a cabin, they wouldn't have to go into the cabin, but they'd be able to see stuff in the well of the deck that they wouldn't have been able to seize otherwise. And they could have already done this under the statute in Section 7. But it sounds to me like this will allow the police to bootstrap themselves into a warrantless search. Am I right?
Well, through the chair. Pardon me?
Representative Gruenberg, this is Julie Leckie, for the record. Staff to Representative Mike Hawker. Section 7, which is, I mean, I think it already contains the law that says that they may stop, and if the peace officer has probable cause to believe a violation of this chapter has occurred. That's the current law.
No, I understand that. I'm beyond that. My question is, under the current law and under the new law in Section 8, will they be able to seize things that would be in view only when they can actually have legally boarded the vessel, where they couldn't have seen it before when they couldn't board the vessel? And I'm wondering, is that going to give them a chance to seize things that they couldn't have otherwise done without a warrant under the plain view doctrine?
Well, through the chair, this section is the lead into it is AS 0525080 is repealed and reenacted by Section 18, Chapter 28, SLA 2000. Is amended to read. So actually, I didn't do this particular section, but it doesn't change the law as it is now. It doesn't add anything or take anything.
Representative Gruenberg, can I restate the question just so we understand? So you understand that this section is not being changed by our bill, but your question is whether or not under current law they are allowed to board and seize. Is that correct?
Right. It will give them, and my question is broader than what the change in the law is here. But as I understand it, since you're talking about the change in the law, and I don't want to get distracted by that, my question is really a search and seizure question. And I can get an answer, maybe I should get a legal answer in writing for somebody on this. But, and that would satisfy me. But what this does is simply give the police officer under Section 8 a legal reason to board where they didn't have it before, that being probable cause to believe that a violation of the chapter has occurred. Previously, it said the peace officer may enforce the chapter and in the exercise of enforcement board watercraft. It didn't specifically say probable cause. I don't want to get hung up in that. And I can just get a legal opinion. I'm sorry, I'm wasting a lot of time here. I can get that from Ledge Legal. May I go on, Mr. Chair? This is not productive. Okay, Section 14, page 4, the deletion on line 17, B in writing. Is that a requirement that's elsewhere in the bill? So we're not saying that there can be a citation that is not in writing.
Just
just yes or no. Am I correct that there is a requirement elsewhere that a citation be in writing through the chair?
What section are you on, please?
I'm on section 14, page 4, line 17.
Through the chair, I read that, and I could not conceive of a citation other than in writing.
Well, my question is there in AS 12.25.175 through 12.25.230 a requirement that a citation be in writing? Because if there isn't, it seems to me that we should have it somewhere that citations must be in writing. And if you don't have an answer, then I can get that from you in writing. I don't want to put you guys on the spot. I just want to know, is there a requirement that a citation must be in writing? I think there should be.
Well, I think a citation has to contain certain things, and those things would necessarily be in writing.
I would appreciate if you could give me, through the chair, a page and line where there's a requirement that it be in writing, because if not, I think we need to do an amendment somewhere that's specific. Well, I'm not sure. I'll ask for your, you know, you guys are drafting. May I continue, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Through the chair to Representative Holmes, you, while you were asking your question, I was trying to go through the thing and find where my questions had been. Did you get an answer to your question, page 6, lines 10 and 11, reasonably believes versus reasonable and probable cause? Were you satisfied with the answer?
Mr. Chairman, if I may, yes, I was.
Okay, let me continue on. There is something in here, folks, and I can't, oh, here we are, Mr. Chair. Page 4, and I hope you're okay. You okay? Okay. On page 4, line 5, and this language appears elsewhere in the bill, that requires that the department deposit the citation and a copy with the court on or before the 10th working day after its issuance. I want something to be certain that if it fails to do that in a timely fashion, that's not grounds for a motion for dismissal.
And through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, if you look on page 9, it's going to be lines 21 through 22, and this is...
Thank you. Answers my question.
And through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, Ms. Lucky also pointed out on page 6, at the bottom of the page, line 30, Section 23, statute 12.25.190, says the officer shall prepare a written citation and issue it to the person.
Thank you.
That's it.
I appreciate that.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? How do we do?
I will yield for a minute because I'm still going through, but thank you.
Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a few minutes ago, we took out has reasonable and probable cause to believe, and we substituted reasonably believes. That was on page 6, up around line 10. To go back a few pages, we use the word probable cause again and again.
Okay.
Unless there's a difference between probable cause and reasonably believed, should we not ask that the language remain consistent throughout the bill?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, in the use, and one of the questions earlier was if a officer has probable cause to believe that a violation of a chapter occurred, they may board a boat. That probable cause indicates a particular offense that had been charged, and I'll use assault as an example. If a person causes physical injury to someone, that's an element, and if so, that has to be there. As far as if an officer believes someone is dangerous in order to make an arrest rather than issue a citation, there are no elements to a dangerous person. It's an officer's reasonable belief in what he sees on the street. There's nothing in any crime, probable cause means you have to have probable cause to believe each and every element has occurred. So I didn't think that probable cause fit that particular section.
Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to return to section 14, the dialogue about complying with 12, 25, 175 to 230, and we're deleting B in writing. And so I went and looked at those sites, and doesn't the words written citation mean the same thing?
Yeah.
Yes. Representative Greenberg. Thank you. Two questions. This is first is a stylistic thing, and I would ask our staff and Ms. Lucky. Normally, when and I know sometimes when the AG drafts something, it's a little different style than when our ledge legal do it. But like in Section 24, we don't customarily say AS 12 umpteum as repealed and reenacted and blah, blah, blah is amended to read. I think all we have to say there is AS 12-25-190C. And I would just ask the staff and Ms. Lucky to please, I think we can eliminate that other stuff. And there are several statutes where that appears, and I would ask that can be done in a technical way.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, there are two sections, and it's sections 8 and 24 of the bill. The problem is that that was part of the Boating Safety Act, and it will be repealed, and so that's why there's two duplicative sections. So instead of being able to just say our new law is going to read this, we have to go back into the SLAW and also edit the SLAW, because when the sunset, the Boating Safety Act sunset happens, the old, the way that the sunsets work, the previous statute is going to take the place of the new statute. So that's why.
Now, as John Travolta was saying, as I said, I'm thoroughly confused. I'll leave that to you folks.
Well, and you can see, I tried to explain that as well as possible, but you can see that sections 8 and 24 have a different effective date, because those are conditional on the Boating Safety Act eventually sunsetting. So if the Boating Safety Act never sunsets, 8 and 24 will never come into play, but that's why they're written that way, because they have to edit the SLAW and not the current statute.
Okay. Secondly, on page 5, section 21, the thing I'm concerned about is that these citations, the form, the exact form is going to be done by the Commissioner of Public Safety, and I want that to be done. I think the law should require that when that's done, it's done by regulation under the APA. And my concern is that on line 30, it simply says may. I would like to change that to shall, because otherwise the commissioner could simply say, I'm going to adopt standards and I choose not to do it by reg, since you have the permissive may rather than shall. And I would intend to, if you understand and agree with.
Where's that reference at, please?
I'm talking about page 5, line 30.
Oh, line 30.
So changing the may to shall, and that will make it clear that the form of the regs must go through the regular notice and public comment procedure for adoption of regulations under the Administrative Procedures Act.
I'd like to hear from Sue Stancliffe or Lieutenant Dial about that, about whether what the may and a shall, those are significant.
Through the chair, I agree with Representative Gruenberg, and I'm, you know, have no doubt that the Commissioner of Public Safety would be adopting regulations, and any regulation would have to be pursuant to AS 4462. But since citations will be affect the general public, it would have to be a regulation. So I think.
Doesn't this go to, we were talking that we're migrating toward an electronic citation form. So, Lieutenant Dial, should it be may at this point, or should it be shall, or shall get ahead of where the system is right now because of the nature of migrating to electronic citations? Thanks for the help.
For the record, my name is Rodney Dowd, Lieutenant with Alaska State Troopers. At this time, the department would prefer to keep it as may, although we would not necessarily oppose the change to shall, because we believe that we would use those, adopt those regulations anyway.
Mr. Chair, may
Representative Gruenberg.
I would hope you could accept the amendment, because I think it is extremely important in something like this that you have opportunity for public comment.
Any question, Bill?
On the form of the regs, and I would hope that that would meet your approval. Through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg. I see no reason why we could not accept that amendment. I just haven't had time to research that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The chair prefers May. Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'd like to go back to Section 22, Lines 10, 11. And I know that there's been questions pursuing this, and maybe I missed it. And I do understand the part about reasonably believes on line 10, line 11, when a person is a danger to self and others. Is there any place else that this would be changed? I haven't had time to really look through it. Where we do change it from reasonable and probable cause to believe to reasonably believes beyond this specific site of danger to self and others?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, I don't have the answer to that, but I can find out. I know there's something similar in Title 47, the mental commitments, but it's a finding made by a judge. And I don't know if it's precisely the same language, but it is somewhat similar.
Mr. Chairman, I guess that, yes, I look forward to that that answer. I just there's something about this. I'll reserve concern. I'm not convinced that this is where we should be at.
Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Probably for Mr. Lieutenant Dial, or maybe you can answer it. But it goes back to the question on page 5, line 30, substituting shall for may, as proposed by Representative Gruenberg. Curiously, as a matter of course, does the Commissioner of Public Safety regularly adopt regulations under AS 4462? And if not, is there an alternative?
Through the chair, anyone who in Alaska who adopt, any commissioner or commission or board that adopts regulations adopts it in that under that those statutes in Title 44. I would point out paragraph B right above that says the Commissioner of Public Safety shall provide or prescribe citation forms for use by peace officers and may adopt regulations. I'm backtrack a little bit. I'm agreeing with Representative Gruenberg, not that I wouldn't want to agree with you, but currently the things that are required to be in a citation are in statute, in court rule, and the Department of Public Safety currently has a uniform citation that they use, and some other police agencies around the state also use that. And they all comply with the statutes and the law. And I don't know that there's, at this point, I don't know if the Department of Commissioner of Public Safety has adopted regulations regarding citations, but any regulations that are adopted under 4462.
And as a follow-up, Mr. Chair, do we handicap ourselves by using the word shall, such that there may be some regulations that ought to be established outside of 44062, and now we are required, if we substitute shall, to use 4462?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, in my many years of looking at statutes, I'm constantly amazed at how many times I find things that I didn't find before. This past week, there are several things. Ms. Lucky just pointed out that Section 48 under Title 44, Alaska Statute 4441020, is amended by adding a new section. The Department of Public Safety shall establish by regulation standardized forms for citations. So under the earlier section 21, the commissioner may adopt regulations, but another section it says they shall. So any regulations that are adopted shall be under Title 44.
Got it.
Representative Herron.
I'm good.
Sir. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would be satisfied. I think maybe, because it looked to me like Section 21 only related to the forms of the citation.
It's a format.
And, pardon me? Oh, it looks like that section only relates to the forms of the citation. Am I not correct through the chair?
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, you're talking about the Section 48?
No, 21.
forms of citation?
I think Section 21 only relates to the forms of the citation.
Representative Grunberg, that's how I would read it. I'm not.
Yeah, that's.
Then Mr. Chair, and I'm going back to your comment a minute ago here. The two sections, subsection C at the bottom of page 5, might be read in conflict with section 48 of the bill. And I think that since it's the intent to require regulations under section 48 of the bill, we should change the may to shall on page 5, line 30, so there is no conflict. What do you folks think?
Through the Chair, Representative Grunberg, upon reading both the sections, I fully support your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next. Okay, seeing no more questions, is there anybody else in the room who wishes to testify? We have a couple of people that are available for questions. Diane is with us, the Special Assistant to the Director. Is anybody else online? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. I'd like to offer Amendment Number 1. Julie will speak to it. Amendment Number 1 says offered in the House to HB 386, page 2, line 14. Julie, can you help us with that, please?
Mr. Chairman, I'll object for discussion.
Representative Holmes objects for purposes of discussion.
Mr. Chairman, the amendment is a basically cleanup amendment in some sections. There were a couple of sections where the citations were left out that we found when we were reading through the statutes that there was a citation where we didn't put in the correct language. And there is also the removal of language stating the citation is considered a summons for a failure to obey a citation under AS 1225-230, and the court may issue a bench warrant. And if it pleased the committee, I would prefer Mr. Brower talk to that language. Apparently, it was confusing language. Our drafting attorney also pointed this out, but I think I'd prefer to have an attorney go on record and explain it.
Briefly.
And that's removing the language, the citation shall be considered a summons for failure to obey a citation. Well, that's the language I had. Numerous of the statutes indicated that if someone was cited into court, could either pay a fine or go to court and did neither, then the citation would be considered a summons for a misdemeanor. And I think that language was basically meaningless. If the original citation was for a violation, it couldn't convert into a misdemeanor.
Okay,
but
thank
it's
you.
Clear that if you fail to obey a citation, that it would be a violation of that statute, 1225-230.
Thank you. Is the objection maintained?
Mr. Chairman,
May I inquire?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the packet, there was this sheet also. Is that superseded by the amendment, or are we going to be dealing with that too? Ms. Lucky, through the chair. Ms. Brown. I just found that in my folder.
Oh. Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunberg, that was the description of the amendment, and so I put it into a format that we're used to seeing. It is exactly the same thing. This is just in the actual format that we generally do our amendments.
Thank you. No further objection.
I remove my objection.
Without that, Amendment Number 1 is part of the bill. Representative Grunberg, you want to offer Amendment Number 2?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Despite the Speaker's statement earlier,
I heard it.
Yes, you did. Page 5, line 30. Delete may and insert shall.
Object for discussion.
As we discussed a few minutes ago,
without objection, Amendment Number 2 passes. Are there other amendments to the bill? Seeing none, the chair would entertain a motion. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move House Bill 386. 26-LS1525-A with amendments, both written, conceptual, attached fiscal notes, and individual committee recommendations from committee.
And Representative Herron objects for the purposes of discussion. Representative
Herron. Just to reiterate, Mr. Chairman, Section 22, lines 10 and 11, I believe the parameter, the fence is high enough around specific to if a person is a danger to itself or others, I'm just concerned that this change could go someplace else, somewhere else, and I just would remove my objection with that concern.
Thank you. We appreciate your comments being read to the record. The objection is removed. House Bill 386 passes from committee. We'll take a brief at ease.
Thank you, Julie.
Thank you, Mr. Brower. I would like to, I'm going to move the CS for House Bill number 287-26-LS1300/E. Seeing no objection, we have the CS for House Bill 287 before us. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the, may I move the CS for House Bill 287?
It's already been moved.
It's already done. Before us. Okay. This is the Uniform Disclaimer of Property Interests Act, and we have Commissioner Barry Thurman here, who is one of the Alaska commissioners on the Uniform Act, and the bill basically deals with one discrete issue of estate planning, and that is, if a person is given an estate asset in a will or a trust, there may be very good reasons, for example, for tax purposes, where you would wish to skip the
judgment. Right, I hear the bill's up right now.
So that the bequest is not taxed twice. Okay, bye. And that way you could say, I don't want it, but my heirs will get it. And you will save a lot of money in estate taxes. And there is now in the Uniform Probate Code one section that deals with this. But since that section was written and adopted in the early 1970s in Alaska, this has become more complicated and more sophisticated. So the commissioners on uniform state laws have updated this and have enacted an entire act on this. And this adopts that act, and it has been Alaskanized by the trust attorneys, David Schaftel, who I hope is on the line, and some of the other folks. And I've looked at it very carefully with them. We have run it by the uniform commissioners. And as you may recall, Mr. Chair, and I think some of the other folks on the committee, when Gabrielle Ledoux introduced this a few years ago, I had a problem because it didn't make any provision for back child support. It would have allowed somebody to escape paying back child support. So they put a provision in here that will not allow them to escape paying back child support. That's one of the things that's put in here. And as a result of our discussion a few weeks ago, we took one of the Alaska provisions out and put the uniform provision back in. Far as I know, there's no objection from anybody in the field in this. We have Ms. Thurman here, who, would you like me to answer?
Doesn't wish to testify. She, you're doing very well, Representative Grunberg. Okay.
I believe we have Michael Kerr from the Uniform Commissioners, if you have any questions. I believe we have Mr. Schaftel on the line, and they'd be happy to answer.
Mr. Schaftel wishes to offer testimony. Are there any other questions for the sponsor? Seeing none, we'll go to Mr. Schaftel. Mr. Schaftel? No, he's no longer with us. Gretchen, do you have anything to offer?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. For record, my name is Gretchen Staft. I work for Representative Max Gruenberg, and I believe that Mr. Schaftel and Michael Kerr will be calling in shortly.
Schaftel's gone. Mr. Kerr is available for questions. He's the Uniform
They're
Law Commissioner.
They're just available if you folks have any questions.
There don't appear to be any questions. Are there any questions?
I'd just like to thank them for all their work on the bill.
Duly noted on the record. Any questions from any members? Anybody in the audience that wishes to testify on this piece of legislation? Seeing that, public testimony is closed. Representative Grunberg, do you have any amendments to offer to the CS for House Bill 287?
I'm following the Chenault rules.
Directive.
Thank you. We appreciate you updating this part of the statute book as it relates to the Uniform Probate Code. Any questions for Gretchen? Seeing none, the chair would entertain a motion. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move the CS for House Bill number 287, 26-LS1300/E with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Thank you. Without objection, the bill passes from moves from committee. Take a brief at ease.
If you have the vote.
On the record, we have before us the CS for House Bill number 409, version 26-LS1495/S. And Representative Lynn, is this your bill?
Our bill, yes.
Roger that. Who will be Mike Sika? You're going to take us through this?
Okay. I'm making an opening remark here.
Okay. Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee for hearing HB 409 today. It's this bill is crafted to deal with the United States Supreme Court decision on Citizens United, which actually has caused kind of a political earthquake throughout the nation. And this HB 409 is designed to deal with some of that. The bill is not whether we it's not about the decision itself, whether you agree with it, don't agree with it, think it's a good bill, or good ruling or bad ruling. That's not the point. The bill is about letting our constituents throughout the state know who contributes and makes expenditures in the corporations and unions. In other words, the bill is actually, it's a disclosure bill. So people have to disclose what they're doing. The United Citizens decision basically established corporations and unions as persons, and basically they can contribute, make independent expenditures the same as we would as individual candidates. Along that individual, that independent decision is not coordinated in any way with a candidate or somebody putting together an initiative. And I've a special concern about foreigners, foreign nationals, who are on some of these boards of directors, who are part of the decision-making process as to who can, who they're going to support, who they're going to oppose, what initiatives are they going to support, or what are they going to oppose. And we have some language in 409, Mr. Seeger will be talking about, which addresses at least some of those concerns. Elections, everybody and their uncle, is just around the corner. We have gubernatorial elections, we have legislative elections coming up in August. We need to get some sideboards put on that so everybody knows what they're supposed to be doing, including corporations and unions. And I submit that in this type of thing, kind of unexpected decision, time is of the essence. And I'm very proud of the work that my staff at Mike Seeger has done on this, as well as other bills. And I'd like to have him walk you through it.
Mike, welcome. If you introduce yourself for the record, we're happy to have you here.
Through the chair, my name is Mike Sika. I'm staff of Representative Lynn.
Welcome.
And I can do this fairly quickly. Like Representative Lynn said, Alaska is one of 24 states right now that are dealing with having to come up with disclosure and disclaimer laws on independent expenditures by corporations and labor unions and LLCs because, as he said, the Supreme Court ruled that it's no longer constitutional to do that. And we're hoping to fill that gap with 409. And what it basically does is you'll see in many of these sections, we're simply changing the language where we had that semi-complete laundry list of persons, candidate group, non-group, entity, municipality, or individual. Now we're replacing that with the definition of person, which includes corporations, companies, partnership firm, associations, organizations, business trust, society, natural person, union, okay? And you'll see that right from section one, the applicability section. Representative Lynn mentioned the meat of this bill is really the two sections. Section four is the disclosure section. You'll see that on page 3, and section 11 on page 6 is the disclaimer section. And I'll highlight a few more of the sections for you as I go through it. Representative Lynn mentioned in the ruling, the Supreme Court ruled that you can the federal government can still prohibit foreign nationals from being involved in federal and state election campaigns through these independent expenditures. All that we're doing with Section 8 on page 4, we took the federal law, condensed it, the alleged legal drafter, Alpheus Bullard, came up with a shorter language that basically, in his legal opinion, does the same thing, and we think we can get around any preemption problems with the federal government because it basically puts in state code what the federal law does. Okay? And that's page 5 goes into that. A few things happened in several of the committees. If you go to page 5, section 10, we had prohibited expenditures there. There were certain restricted conditions where you can make an anonymous expenditure. That was deleted out. I wanted to point that out. Page 6, section 11, again, we're in the disclaimer section. And when I think what's interesting about this section, when you go to line 19, the D section, okay, what we're doing there is we're requiring that corporations, unions, or LLCs, when they do their campaign advertising or independent expenditure, and this goes over the next two pages, 6 and page 7, if they have an audio and video component to their ad, they will clearly identify the audio, both in audio and in video.
Give me a break. What do you mean audio?
Okay. If you could hear them.
Sound.
Yeah.
Or see them.
Yeah.
They will speak, and you'll be able to hear their voice naming the top three contributors.
You want the audio to say who it was paid for by?
Right. Correct.
And the top three?
Top three.
So give me three names.
Okay. And it would be the common name.
Give me three names.
Okay. I don't know. Alaska Wildlife Foundation.
Friends of the Earth.
Friends of the Earth and BP.
Okay. And just the name, and
I would
name
say
and address?
Juneau, Alaska.
Just go through the chair, please. Name and address or just the name? My question.
It would be the name and address.
Okay, so now give me three names and give me three addresses.
Yeah. Okay, and
can you use that for me, please?
You bet.
Okay, what are the names and what are the addresses?
Okay. BP, Alaska, Juneau, Alaska, Wildlife.
No, not Juneau, Alaska. 564 A Street. What's your plan here? I mean, what does it call for?
What it says right here is the identity, the name and city and state of residence is what it says.
Where? Take me to where?
Okay, go to page 6, line 19, section D.
The name and city and state of residence or principal place of business.
Right, and then when you go to page 6, line 8, to satisfy the requirements of A2C of this section and A2D, basically says the following statement or statements must be read in a manner that is easily heard or placed in the communication so as to be easily discernible, or in a communication that is transmitted by a method that includes both audio and video components, and read in a manner that is easily heard and placed in the communication so as to be easily discernible. And then it says this communication was paid for, the person's name, city and state of principal place of business, and then the top contributors of the person's name, city and state of residence, as applicable. And then if you go down to F, you're allowed to use the person's common name.
Down to F, where's F?
F on line 28.
Page 7.
Page 7, I'm sorry.
Okay, so what are the three names of your organizations?
Exxon Alaska, Juneau, Alaska, Wildlife Society, Anchorage, Alaska, and Friends of Animals, Juneau, Alaska.
Okay, and so clearly discernible. What does that phrase mean? Is that in law now, or are you adding that to law?
That's being added.
Okay, so what does the word clearly discernible mean?
That it can be clearly discerned.
Well, what does it mean? I mean, you know, how fast can you say it? I mean, I've done radio ads before, and you do the paid for by very quickly. What does clearly discernible mean?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lynn.
For me, I think it just means what it says it means.
Hey, what does it mean, Representative Lynn?
It means that a person of normal hearing can understand what is being said.
Well, we speak with the difference.
I hope I'm being clearly discernible myself at this point. Am I?
You are being clearly discernible, but I speak
That's what it means.
But I speak about twice as quickly as you. So am I clearly discernible?
You are.
Okay, so how quickly How quickly can you speak where it's still clearly discernible? I mean, you're making that into a legal term, Representative.
So you're asking, is there a definition? Is that what you're asking, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, what is clearly discernible mean?
Would you like to have an amendment in there to put what clearly discernible means?
No. Well, yes. I'm interested in what clearly discernible means. I'm interested in how long in a 30-second ad it takes to list three top sponsors, Representative Gatto, then Representative Grunberg.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. I guess we've all heard the Worthington Ford ads. Stock number 123456, stock number, all in rapid succession. And you know the person at the station simply increased their speed. So does clearly discernible mean at an unaltered voice speed?
You'll get that box of Kleenex from the police in my office.
Well, that question would be...
Representative Gruber.
Yes, thank you. This happened to be my amendment in the committee.
Imagine that.
We're getting you your Kleenex,
Yes, sir.
What Representative Gatto said was exactly right, but there's a typo, an important typo. It wasn't printed the way I did the amendment. We didn't catch it until now. Mr. Chair, at the appropriate time, I am going to ask for an amendment to conform to what we did in the State Affairs. You gentlemen, it was supposed to be on page 7, line 16, the top three contributors. The word three was omitted. And, Mr. Chair, just for the record, it's supposed to be there. And I'll ask that technical amendment be accepted, because that was when we did it. It was the amendment to amendment number 5 in State Affairs, and it wasn't transcribed right. So it's supposed to be
must not have been clearly discernible.
The clearly discernible was just what Representative Gatto has said. It's got to be able to be heard and understood.
Right, go ahead. Yeah.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I think this section here under D refers to A2D, which lists the top.
Would you say what the page reference, please?
Yeah. When you're looking at page 7, line 8 and 9, it says to satisfy the requirements of A2C of this section, and if applicable, A2D of this section. Then you flip the page back to page 6, and you'll see on line 19, A2D lists the top three.
I see. So it was taken care of. I stand corrected, and I apologize to my staff.
So, Mike, is it required in a television commercial to do an audio of the top three entities also in video, or it just has to be in print at the bottom of the screen?
I understand it to mean that in a television...
Introduce yourself through the record, please.
My name is Mike Sika, Representative...
I just want to keep track of Susan.
Staff Representative Lynn.
So it has to be in television. You have to say the three...
Right. What? Say and show.
What?
I
think because in a lot of the discussions in the committees, there are people that may be visually impaired. They could hear it then. Conversely, there may be people that have hearing problems. They can see it. It's within earshot.
But it's not required presently. I mean, why are we all of a sudden sensitive to something we haven't been since, I've been politically active. You don't have to say it. You don't have to say it presently in a television commercial. I mean, I'm concerned that we have this knee-jerk reaction to this whole ruling. I don't like knee-jerk legislation. It feels like that's what we're doing. Go ahead.
And through the chair, there are lots of commercials we've heard, pharmacy commercials where they use both print and audio. I think it goes a lot to the Supreme Court decision where you're trying to give people as much information as possible to make the best decisions in an election.
I appreciate that. Representative Lynn, and then I have a question for you, Representative Lynn.
Right. On the commercial that these folks would air, this is talking about the elected process. We're not talking about selling Fords. So it's very, very important. And I don't think we have a knee-jerk reaction trying to protect the voters there so they know who is making these expenditures, for or against a candidate, for or against an initiative. We need to know that kind of thing. And knee-jerk is a majority, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, Representative Lynn, right now, if you ran a TV commercial in your last election cycle, you didn't have to say paid for by the Lynn for State House campaign. You didn't have to do that in a television ad. You do it in a radio because audio is the only, it's required in audio. So why are you bringing a whole new level to a television commercial where you're going to repeat the top three deals? I mean, that's what I, do you feel like the voters haven't been aware in previous cycles that it was Lynn for State House?
I'm not sure that they have, but the reading he said. Now, if you'd like to make an amendment to take that out, I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you.
And I'll vote accordingly.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your question answered part of mine, but Representative Lynn, your desire would be that if anyone running for any office were to purchase, say, a 30-second ad, that even if it took 15 seconds of that to disclose their committee, who their top three donors are, and where they're from, you feel that's acceptable?
Go ahead. Let's go through the chair so that we can, Susan can pick this up, please. Representative Lynn, comment?
No comment.
Okay, Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. As I said, this was something that I brought forth. The reason I did this was there are two classes of people it's designed to aid. The first are the visually impaired who listen to television but don't watch it because they can't. And the second group are the rest of us who are sometimes washing or cooking or just doing something else, and we listen to the television. And at that point, it becomes an auditory communication method.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Through the chair. So, Representative Gruenberg, I go back to what Representative Rammers, the chair, just asked previously. Why didn't we care about those two classes of people before?
Representative Gruenberg.
The reason was because I wasn't looking at the bill, maybe. Some of the rest of us are looking at this for the first time. That's why we're here, to do things that maybe for some reason nobody thought of before. I unfortunately don't know who was doing this before. But I do know that in answer to your question, Mr. Chair, the timing for this, the three names has been 8 seconds. And I'd like to just point out that under, I think it's federal law, any time they do an ad for a drug, they have to auditorily state all the potential side effects. That takes a lot longer than 8 seconds, and that's required because people think that's important. And I happen, and I think the State Affairs Committee agreed, to think it's important to identify these folks. Otherwise, it would be dead air time. And
dead air time?
Because there's nothing I'm talking about on the air. It would just be a thing flashed. And this is disclosure, and I think it's particularly important for the people who are not visually watching or the people who can't watch.
Mike Sika.
Yeah. My name is Mike Sika. I could see where the words easily discernible came from. It's already in our code, and you'll see it on page 8 of this bill. Yeah, this is under the section 15.13.135, independent expenditures for or against candidates. And if you go to line 25 and 26, it says, shall place the following statement in mailing, literature, advertisement, or other communication so that it is readily and easily discernible. And I don't know if that answers your question about audibly easily discernible, but I think that's where the language came from.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sika, what you're saying is clearly understandable, and it's very easy to read. I do think we run into a problem of what the legal definition of easily discernible is. I mean, to me, that's just a lawsuit right there. Through the chair, we're looking at all different educational levels of citizens, different cultures, different languages, different everything. And I am for full disclosure. So I'm not arguing at all against full disclosure, but
do we have anybody in the room who wishes to testify on this bill? Yes, come on up. And then Mr. Bullard wants to testify on this bill. Is that right? I have a yes for Mr. Bullard. At the appropriate time. Come on up. Representative Grimberg.
I'm asking staff to get me a dictionary to define discernible. That's the way a court would. They'd look to a regular dictionary.
What a pleasure. Nice to see you.
Thank you. Chairman Ramros, can you hear me online?
I can, Mr. Bullard. If you'll just stand by, please.
Certainly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Don Etheridge. I'm here on behalf of the Alaska State AFL-CIO.
Hey, welcome,
and
Don.
We have not been opposed to the disclosure. We think full disclosure is the right way to do it. That's the way we prefer to do it, and we're fully supportive of it. Our concern is one of the amendments that's on the table. It becomes very cumbersome for our organizations to try and fill the need that's put out in this. Some of our organizations have over 8,000 members that they would have to notify that scattered from one end of this state before we could actually make any kind of expenditures or collect. The way our system is set up and under law, our people already have the options of exempting out of any political action contributions and any political action monies that is spent out of their normal union dues. Under the Beck decision, they can do that. And we just have a real concern over this piece of legislation. We do have committees in most of our organizations that will do, they vote on expenditures. When we have 8,000 people contributing $2, it's kind of hard to have all 8,000 of them being able to stand in at the table and say, yeah, I support this, or no, I don't.
Okay. Other questions for Don? Representative Gatto?
Yeah. Don, are you talking about PAC contributions?
PAC contributions is our what we use for political action.
Sure. And, Mr. Chair, the question we have before us is the Supreme Court decision that says you can use dues, not just PAC contributions. That's really what the issue is. And if you're going to use dues, then we want the dues payers to know. People that contributed to the PAC know. People that didn't don't know. So that's what we're after here, is to let the people who paid the dues know that you're using their dues money to support or oppose a candidate or an initiative or a resolution or whatever. And I think that's pretty important to the dues payer.
Mr. Chairman, under the dues, yes, the member has a right to know, but the way the wording is on this, the contributions, our members make contributions to the political pact. So that's going to be an effect to us. And the way it's worded is our biggest concern, because it does go into our political pacts. It goes into the any other type of funds that we may be coming across.
Mr. Delgado?
Yeah. Don, where are we talking about political PACs here? We're not. We understand the law on PACs. We don't have a law that says currently that we would like to know how the dues is spent. PACs we have a long history of PACs. You join a PAC, if you don't know what the PAC is going to do, you shouldn't send them your money. So let's assume everyone knows. What we're dealing with is dues.
Mr. Chairman, is what the words are saying in here.
Well,
is
refer to what you're looking at.
On the first page here.
Of the bill?
Line of the amendment.
Which
first page of the amendment.
Which amendment?
Why are we talking about the amendment? It hadn't even been offered.
Yeah, Don, we don't have any amendments before the committee.
Yes, sir, I understand that.
Okay.
But the bill itself, as is, we have no problems with. Okay. If this amendment is put in it, we do have a problem with it.
Okay. And if that amendment put in, that your concern is?
The way it's worded is it says that any dues or fees or contributions, any membership contribution dues or fees is the wording that's in here. And our political PACs are contributions.
Duly noted. Okay. Any testimony to offer on the bill, or you're okay with the bill?
The bill, we're fine with, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Okay, is there anybody else in the room that wishes to testify? So we'll go to Mr. Bullard online. Mr. Bullard?
Good afternoon, Chairman Ramrath and members of the committee. This is Alpheus Bullard of Legislative Legal Services. And while I do not wish to provide an opinion on the bill, I thought that I might be of some help in clarifying your discussion regarding the disclaimer provisions of 1513090.
Okay, shoot.
If you go to page 7 of the bill, lines 12 and 13, the line following the comma, be read in a manner that is easily heard. That is the portion of that line that modifies audio communications. To be placed in a communication refers to print or video. You'll see the same usage in the section that Mr. Sika identified on page 8 of the bill, lines 20 and 21. While colloquially, people discern things with their ears, to discern is a visual function. So audio communications just merely must be read in a manner that is easily heard. Secondly, I heard some discussion from committee members about this affecting candidate elections. If you return to page 6 of the bill, lines 11 and 12, this disclaimer applies only to a person other than a candidate, individual, or political party. Do any of the members have questions on these points?
Any questions? Seeing none, we thank you, Mr. Bullard. Anybody else in the room or online that wishes to testify?
Mr. Chair, this is Holly Hill, Executive Director of the Alaska Public Offices Commission. I don't want to testify, sir, but I wanted to point out that our current regulation, 2 AAC 50.306, specifies currently the definition of clearly identified. And in all audio-visual, automated telephone or electronic communications, the information must be A, visual and of sufficient size and duration to be read by the viewer, B, spoken and audible at the same volume as the communication, or C, both visual and spoken as set out in A and B. That's all I had, sir.
Thank you, Holly. Any other questions for Holly with APOC? Seeing none, we thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else online or in the room that wishes to testify?
Seeing this is John Patasson with Department of Law.
Hi, John.
Hi. I'd like to make a few comments about 409. Okay. First, in general, just to note that any disclaimer and disclosure law which burdens free speech is still subject to strict scrutiny, and the laws proposed must be narrowly tailored to serve compelling government interests. The courts may be called upon to review these laws in the future, so I thought I would make a few comments about some of the sections as they are in House Bill 409. Section 4 certainly seeks more disclosure from corporations, companies, and labor unions, and on two occasions it mentions a suspect classification, nationality, and that's in sub 4 and sub 5B. The bill would require officers, directors, and contributors to report their nationality on APOC forms within 24 hours of making the expenditure. I would note that Citizens United did not address whether there's a compelling government interest to keep foreign influence out of political speech and candidate elections. The issue just wasn't before the court. So the concept behind this particular law of keeping foreign speech out of local elections or state or even federal elections, it just wasn't addressed by the court. So we're not sure if there's a compelling government interest there or not. But nevertheless, this type of classification is subject to strict scrutiny. Not only because it may or may not burden free speech, it's also a suspect classification. Under federal law, foreign nationals aren't permitted to participate at all in the decision-making process when it comes to this type of expenditure. And under the addition of 068 in House Bill 409, it further wouldn't allow for foreign nationals to make this type of, to be a part of the process of making this type of expenditure in a candidate election. So the question really is whether it's significant enough for a corporation or labor union to tell in the AIPOC filings that they have foreign nationals essentially acting as leaders in their organizations, despite the fact that the law already requires that they have nothing to do with the expenditure process. Whether there's a compelling government interest, narrowly tailored, or a real harm there, the courts would have to vet that idea if called upon to do so. With respect to 068, there has been discussion, and that's Section 8 of the bill, there has been discussion whether there's federal preemption here. There is no conflict between the federal and the proposed law here that I see. I think there may be some argument for field preemption because there is substantial federal regulation in this area. Nevertheless, it doesn't seem that federal preemption should be an issue for Section 8. Section 10, the McIntyre decision, that requires that be placed back in. Some expenditures under U.S. constitutional jurisprudence just need to remain anonymous, and that's individuals essentially leafletting. Section 12 has a section about pre-certification speech that is not defamatory. That may be too onerous a burden to place on an officer of a corporation or labor union. I know Representative Seaton is considering a conceptual amendment there. I can discuss that further if Mr. individuals have questions.
Mr. Seaton doesn't sit on this committee.
No, okay, I understand that. So, and then with Section 12 as well, there's a requirement that foreign government ownership be disclosed in the advertisements if the foreign government is a 10% owner. Again, whether there's a compelling government interest, a court may be called upon to vet whether there's an interest there, given that foreign nationals cannot be a part of the process in the expenditure. And finally, the proposed law requires 24-hour reporting of the expenditure within 24 hours of an expenditure being made, incurred, or authorized. Given that standard, the 24-hour rule is going to require close accounting from third-party vendors, from individuals making expenditures. Reporting accuracy may or may not suffer given the 24-hour standard. The 10-day standard allows for individuals, entities making these types of expenditures time to get a fair and accurate reporting together before they file with APOC. And furthermore, with a 24-hour turnaround as proposed by 409, there would be a lot of single filings where with the 10-day rule, you could have done a number of independent expenditures on one form. And I just I raise the issue of whether the 24-hour rule is the most appropriate way to get the filings most clear and most accurate to the public. Beyond that, I do think that anywhere in these laws, House Bill 409, that wherever ambiguity can be cleared up, that's certainly better for the enforceability of these laws going forward. So with that, I'm here to answer any questions, or if anybody has questions after, they can always contact Department of Law. We can work through issues with the bill. Thanks.
Thank you, John. Are there any questions for John? Seeing none, we thank you. Is there anybody else in the room or online that wishes to testify? Yes, Barbara. What's behind you, Max? Hi, Barbara.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Barbara Hutt-Technis. I'm the Director of Governmental and Legislative Affairs for Teamsters Local 959. I'd like to go on record supporting CS for House Bill 409 as it currently exists. I understand we have amendments out there which we cannot address, but in general, I think from both sides, from a corporate perspective as well as from a labor perspective, we recognize, and I guess as a result of this most recent Supreme Court decision, embrace a level playing field, for lack of a better word. If you're going to make requirements of a corporation, we would expect those same requirements be put on us as a labor organization. I think where we do become a little bit different, we have a corporation out there who has stockholders. We have, of course, as a labor union, we have members, our members. In fact, many of you have participated in our membership candidate interview process. We do involve our members. They are part and parcel to every activity that we're involved in. As elected officials, if we are not engaging our membership, of course, we suffer as elected officials. I'm sure that you understand. So from a general perspective, we've supported the bill as it's moved through the various committees. And I think more than anything else that the bill as it's drafted continues to create a level playing field for both sides. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Barbara? Seeing none, we thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else in the room who wishes to testify? Anybody online? Public comment is closed. I'm going to set this bill aside. It's 2:30. We're adjourned. Thank you.